Well, this is fun. Are clergy supposed to have fun? Well, whether we're supposed to or not, we do. And this group of clergy that I've been fortunate enough to get to know over this past year is a fun group. We meet a couple of times a month as a support group and to come up with ideas to enhance our ministries, individual ministries, and our collective ministry. And during the season of Lent, we wanted to do a couple of things. We wanted to explore a Christian way of being that is open to questions. So often the popular voice and face of Christianity is one that wants to tell people what they must believe. That isn't any of us. And that's not why people probably come to our congregations. It's time, we thought, to be a bit more vocal on what a questioning Christianity is. And the second thing we wanted to do is to introduce our congregations to our clergy friends. It's kind of fun to introduce our friends to other friends. So I don't know if this is going to be more fun for you than it is for us, but it is going to be fun for us. And all of us are looking forward to this preaching in different settings. And as we've already had 1 week last week, and the next three will be as well. So what you'll get are some different perspectives, some different voices, and we hope an opportunity to share and live the questions. And on April 10th, put that in the back of your mind, we're planning a gathering for everyone, all members and friends of all the churches, to come together for that greatest of Christian holy meals, the potluck. And we'll share what this experience has been like. So more details will come on the specifics of that. So the five of us, we brainstormed together and came up with questions that each of us had and that we'd like to share. And my question's a bit tricky to pin down. The one that just popped into my head as we were doing this was Cain, when he said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" That's the question that Cain, the farmer, was asked, or asks God, after he kills his brother the shepherd, and God asks Cain where Abel his brother is. "Where's your brother?" And Cain replies, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" So I wanted to talk about violence. Is violence ingrained in the human condition? Does the Bible think, and is it true, that we are natural born killers? Or do we have a choice to do something else? When we witness violence, do we just shake our heads and say, "Well, humans will be humans," and then build up our security forces? And what about the character of God, particularly the character of God in the Bible? What do we do with God's violence? In both testaments, Christ comes. In the book of Revelation, for those who think that the New Testament's all about peace, Christ comes in the book of Revelation on a war horse. And the blood of the unrighteous comes up to the horse's bridles for 200 miles. That violent streak is throughout the Bible. And so it leads to this question: is religion good for humanity or not? Does religion inspire more violence in the name of a violent God? Or can religion help us choose nonviolence? And these are real questions. You know, someone called KBOO complaining about my program. The listener hadn't heard the program, just the promo for it. And the complaint wasn't even about the topic of that particular show. The listener couldn't bear the idea of a program about religion. The listener said, "Religion for life? Religion isn't for life. Religion is for death." I have an interview coming up with a gentleman named Dan Barker, an evangelical preacher turned atheist. His latest book is entitled, "God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction." And it provides a catalog, by quoting the Bible itself, of all the bad characteristics that God demonstrates. Is he right? Is God, the Bible, Christianity, the whole of it, a bad idea whose end needs to come before we destroy ourselves? In my first church, I led them through a reading of the Bible in a year. And one of my church members, a school teacher with young children, came up to me angry. He thought it'd be a good idea, you know, to read the Bible with his kids, a spiritual adventure, teach the children about morality and so forth. And so he gets to the part where God says to kill all the Canaanites, including women and children. And he's angry with me for having him read this book. This isn't even about human beings murdering others. It's about God telling them to do it. I said, "Yeah, I guess I should have put a warning label on it first." No amount of apology, no defending or excusing God will work. We have to deal with the violence of God, the God who orders ethnic cleansing, the God who destroys nearly every human being, including all the animals. What did they do in a flood? The God whose Christ rides his horse through rivers of blood and sends the vast majority of humans to eternal fire because they believe the wrong things. More and more people, especially young people, are saying no thanks to the Christian faith, its Bible, and its God. Too violent, too narrow, too toxic. And yet, here you are, you sitting here today, those of us who say, but that isn't all of the story, is it? A book I highly recommend from an author who has helped me more than any other in regards to Christianity and the Bible is John Dominic Crossan. His latest book is called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. Struggling with Violence from Genesis to Revelation. I would say that Professor Crossan and a few others such as Marcus Borg and Bob Funk, Elaine Pagels, Jack Spong, helped me to remain a Christian. And the reason is because they took the questions honestly. They didn't offer an apology for the faith, but helped me in my search for a Christianity that's worth embracing. All right, so let's start at the beginning. Why would Columbus, Shakespeare, and Bishop Usher declare that earth and heaven was about 6,000 years old? It was commonly believed in the 16th and 17th centuries, by going through the Bible itself, one could, with patience, calculate creation's beginning by counting up the lifespans of Adam and Eve's descendants that are conveniently provided in the genealogies. Bishop Usher calculated the date of creation, 4004 BC, October 23rd, to be precise. It was a Saturday. Creation began at dusk. Now, of course, we laugh at it because we know now the universe is 14 billion years old, Earth is 4.5 billion years old, all of life, including humankind, has evolved over hundreds of millions of years through natural selection. As I shared with the children a couple of weeks ago, we're related to all of life. A banana we had for breakfast shares half our DNA, so we should remember that we're eating our cousin. But the interesting question is this. Why did the biblical authors in the collective set the creation story, the earliest creation parables, in this time period, 4000 BC, and in this place, the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq? Other myths of creation that predate Genesis have time periods and characters several hundred thousand years previous. So why didn't the Bible use those dates? Why 4000 BC? Why the Euphrates and the Tigris? Genesis chapter 2, the second creation story, begins in modern-day Iraq in the midst of the Neolithic Revolution, the dawn of civilization. That is the setting. That time period from 6 to 12,000 years ago marked the shift from hunting and gathering to agriculture, to permanent settlements, to the establishment of social classes, to cities, and to the need to protect excess produce, to standing armies. And here's where we find our brothers, Cain and Abel. Cain, the first human born on earth, and Abel. Now, let's not be silly. These are fictions. These are not real people. Cain the farmer and Abel the shepherd are based on an earlier Sumerian myth. And there are a number of Sumerian myths of the type of what's better, this or that. And in this particular story in the Sumerian myth, the question is, what's better, a farmer or a shepherd? And according to the story, the goddess Inanna, the queen of heaven, is told by her brother to marry the shepherd god, Dumuzid, not the farmer god, Enkidu. They're brothers. But she does not want to marry the shepherd. She wants the farmer. And the shepherd god, Dumuzid, is upset. And he says, well, why is the farmer better than me? And he compares his products to those of the farmer. My stuff's as good as my brother's. Then the shepherd god starts a quarrel with the farmer god, Enkidu, but Enkidu doesn't take the bait to get into a conflict, and he says, you know, we can share. You let your sheep eat on the riverbank and eat the stubble of my fields. And so the dispute ends with Inanna marrying the shepherd after all, and they all invite Enkidu to the wedding. The brothers end up friends. Dumuzid the shepherd becomes Abel, and Enkidu the farmer becomes Cain in our biblical story. And it doesn't end so nicely, as we know. Like the Sumerian myth, there's a contest of sorts, typical of these myths. Abel brings his shepherd offering, Cain brings his farmer offering. God regards Abel's offering, not Cain. No reason is given. God prefers one over the other, just like Iana prefers one over the other. And so Cain becomes angry. And then God has a conversation with Cain, and the Lord says to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen?" You know what that means, right? You've seen your countenance. We had our three-year-old nephew visit. Every now and then his countenance would fall. Anyway, his countenance was also happy the next moment. But why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Another translation has it that you will master it, not you must master it. This is the first we hear of sin in the Bible. Adam and Eve do not sin by eating the fruit. The original sin is Cain's sin that lurks at the door, that he is able to master. And that sin is violence. Cain does not master the sin. Instead, he kills his brother. So in the story, the character, God, does not actually punish Cain himself. It's the ground, Adama, where we get the word Adam, that curses Cain. God is offering sort of a play-by-play. The consequence of violence is the curse. The violence itself will make Cain a fugitive. And Cain expresses the fear that he'll be killed, and so God says no. He puts a mark on Cain. And that mark of Cain, we might also think, is the mark of civilization. Any who kills you will be avenged sevenfold. Not by God, but by other humans. This is what happens with violence. Violence begets violence. Cain goes off, and what's he do? He builds a city. And his descendants demonstrate also the marks of civilization. Livestock, music, iron tools. And then we get to Lamech. Lamech, a descendant of Cain, boasts. Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I've killed a young man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, surely Lamech 77-fold. You might remember those numbers in the Gospels when Peter asks how many times should he forgive one who has hurt him. 7 times? And Jesus says no. The answer is 77-fold. An obvious reference to Lamech's boast. Now, God's not doing the avenging in this case, the character God. Humans are doing the avenging. What we have here from Cain to Lamech is escalatory violence. That's the byproduct of civilization. Civilization doing its normal thing. The mark of civilization, the mark of Cain, is agriculture, cities, iron, bronze, music, cars, the internet, hamburgers, B-2 bombers, and escalatory violence. According to the biblical story, escalatory violence is not inherent. Violence on the scale that Lamech boasts is the byproduct of surplus goods, the byproduct of civilization. Ronald Wright, in his book, The History of Progress, wrote, "From the first chipped stone to the first smelted iron took nearly 3 million years. From the first iron to the hydrogen bomb took only 3,000. But hydrogen bombs and nuclear subs are normal and necessary, right? I mean, you have to have a strong defense, right? Because humans are natural-born killers. Perhaps you do for the normalcy of civilization, but that's not because humans are natural-born killers. It isn't because of human nature. Genesis 4 is not about simple fratricide, an isolated case of brother killing brother. It's a myth that tells the truth, in a way, the story of escalatory violence that arises alongside of civilization, particularly with the managing of surplus. Crossan argues that throughout the Bible, we have a heartbeat. This first beat is a faint heartbeat. It's the heartbeat of distributive justice, where everyone has enough. all live in peace with justice. The creation of earth is in God's image. The Sabbath day is there so all may rest, including the animals. And then immediately following that is this loud heartbeat. And that's the normalcy of civilization and retributive violence. And this is where God becomes violent all of a sudden. It's within God, the character himself. One hand, peace, and then boom, right back with stay on message. So that's why we find the character God kind of bipolar, so to speak. On one hand, through the prophets, he says marvelous, beautiful things, like we read in our call to worship. Turn swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. God declares a year of jubilee, where all debts are wiped clean. People start over again. God invites all to come to my holy mountain, where no one harms another. Jesus, the historical Jesus, not the Christ of Revelation, says, love your enemies. Then you have quickly responding ethnic cleansing, slavery, retribution, by the character God. Christ on his war horse in Revelation, all commanded by this character. Now, we know the Bible is a human product. God is the character of story making. Yet the stories they wrote are about the human condition. They're asking the same questions back then that we are asking now. Are human beings naturally violent? What do we do with that? And they told those stories through the stories of the gods that they talked about. Are we naturally violent, or is this violence, including the violence of God, the result of decisions made in the matrix and the challenges of civilization? The Bible contains two messages. One is the possibility that we can master the violence. We will. The original sin. And then, as quick as that second heartbeat, civilization doing its normal thing and saying that peace only comes through violence and victory and retribution. So how do we know which God is real? How do we know our human destiny? Is the path to peace through distributive justice, life for everyone, or retributive justice, violence and revenge? The contest within the Bible itself, within the character of God itself, according to Crossan, is the kingdom of God, to use Jesus' phrase, versus the kingdom of Caesar, the kingdom of civilization. Caesar wasn't a bad guy. He's normal. I mean, you have to crucify people, strike them with drones, imprison them, control the whole world with your military in order to keep the good stuff flowing to those for whom empire blesses. That's how it works. And as Christians, we read the Bible through the lens of the biblical Christ, but we read the biblical Christ through the lens of the historical Jesus. And if there's a red letter saying of Jesus, it's this one. Jesus said, love your enemies. Crossan bets it all on that. Puts his faith on that altogether. He bets it all on the belief that Jesus was nonviolent. And I agree with him. The message of Jesus' parables was that we get peace through justice, not through victory and conquest. The normalcy of civilization is violence, but that's not necessarily human nature. We can do better. It's kind of if it's election time. And Jesus is running against Caesar. And Caesar's platform is peace through victory. You dominate. You get bigger and better guns. You build walls. You win. You get peace for the elect and quiet for the rest. Jesus' platform, on the other hand, is peace through justice. You build peace by making sure everyone has enough. You build bridges. You educate. You heal. You practice an open table. When people have access, freedom, autonomy, enough, you get peace for everyone. What do you believe? A look at our recent history shows who we believe. Out of fear, we've chosen those who promise peace for the few through violence. And that's why the heartbeat of distributive justice is so faint. It isn't an Old Testament versus New Testament thing. The God of distributive justice is throughout Scripture. We barely hear it because the God of retribution is so loud and so immediate. But as we picture God, so we picture ourselves. And the faint promise is that we can master the original sin of escalatory violence. We can choose something different. We can. We must. We will. So in a sense, in an answer to my own question, I think that religion can be a force for human dignity and for nonviolence. Love your enemies, build peace, That's the divine message of the Bible as I see it, and of the Quran, for that matter. We decreed to the children of Israel that he who kills a soul, it's as if he killed the whole of humankind, whereas he who saves a soul, it's as if he saved the whole of humankind. I remain a Christian and a religious person in general because I think the heart of the message is not that humankind is violent, but that violence is the result of our choices, and we can choose another path. We can choose to build peace, to make choices for health care, for food, for water, for access to the fruit of the earth for all people. We can make that choice. We can make that choice every day. And we can also choose, as Cain did, to shrug with indifference. Am I my brother's keeper? We can let our fear and our cynicism master us, and we can excuse it with the resignation that violence is inevitable. Load up, lock and load. We got to get ours, protect ours, secure ours, and defeat the opposition before they get us. That, according to the Bible, is original sin. Sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. And I think we will.